The facts are hard to spin. Planned Parenthood's name and reputation are intertwined with abortion because it is the nation's largest abortion provider and promoter.
Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life, speaking at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Despite cries that the group is under this huge funding attack and what are they going to do if all this money, tax money, is not available, and yet they brought in $1.6 billion. People associate Planned Parenthood with abortion because that's what it does. We can call it anything, but it's cold-blooded killing, the murder of unborn children. And calling it health care does not change that.
You can listen to Carol Tobias's presentation, Making the Case Against Planned Parenthood, on a recording from this year's Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you along with a recording of 15 Advent and Christmas hymns for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300. Order today at issuesetc.org.
Planned Parenthood agreed that the words on the video were the actual words of the Planned Parenthood personnel. They agreed to that statement. You remember in public they've been saying, oh, deceptively edited. When push came to shove in court where you need evidence, they meekly conceded that, yes, we said all those words.
If you want a divorce for any reason or no reason, you will always get what you want. You will always get divorced. And you can't think of any other civil dispute where you walk into court and you know in advance which side is going to win.
Many pastors who get in trouble have not been able to get the visitation thing going. And it's so vital. It's so parallel to what our Lord did, what St. Paul did, what pastors in the New Testament do.
Wisconsin turkey producers love Issues Etc.
The headline in the Salt Lake Tribune is Polygamy Lives On in LDS Temple, Spurring Agony, Angst, and a Key Question, Who Will Be Married to Whom in Heaven? It's a brief history of polygamy in the LDS Church. I wonder, things are culturally and legally in flux now, but in light of something like Obergefell, where a redefinition of marriage has been instituted nationwide, why not redefine more? And if polygamy at some point becomes legal, will Mormons return to the practice, not just of spiritual polygamy, but of literal and legal polygamy? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 26th of November. Bill McKeever joins us here for the next few minutes to talk about the Salt Lake Tribune story about the history of polygamy and Mormonism. A little later, the origins of Thanksgiving Day with Cheryl Magnus and our second movie review, It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood with Pastor Ted Geese. Bill McKeever is founder of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. He's author of several books, including In Their Own Words, a collection of Mormon quotations, and Mormonism 101. Bill, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
I would not have even entertained this question 10 years ago, but in light of the changing definition, legal definition of marriage in the United States, I don't think it's unreasonable to at least open up the possibility that polygamy could be legal nationwide at some point in the near future. If it were, what do you think? Do you think that Mormons would return to the practice if it were legal?
That's an excellent question. I've been asked that many times. I don't think there is a hard answer to that, only to say this. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has spent much of its history trying to garner the appreciation, if you will, from the evangelical community. And since most evangelicals find the practice of polygamy to be repugnant, I tend to think the leadership would be slow in going in that direction because it would not be a public relations coup with a lot of the people that they're wanting to win over. And for that reason, I doubt it. However, as this article points out, and what I think a lot of people miss, this idea of eternal polygamy or celestial polygamy is certainly a part of Mormonism today. The question you're asking is, are they going to go back, possibly, to the way they practiced polygamy in the 19th century? And though they did abandon that with the manifesto, at least partially in 1890, and then again when the church came out with another manifesto, the 1904 manifesto, they abandoned it as far as how it was practiced earlier. but they always maintain this idea that men could be sealed to more than one woman in the hereafter. And that's the word, sealed, sealing. It can only be done in a Mormon temple, and a man can only be sealed to another woman if she has not been sealed for eternity to another man previously. What that means is the door is open for an LDS male. If his spouse should die, he can marry another woman who is not already sealed. If she was to die, he could be married to yet another woman if she was not also previously sealed. Now, the two top men in the LDS Church right now, Russell M. Nelson, who's the prophet, seer, and revelator, the 17th president of the church, and his first counselor, Dallin Oaks, are both sealed to more than one woman. And I'm sure they have every hope in the next life of being married to both of them. That's why this issue is so touchy. A lot of women in the church are very concerned about this idea, especially the younger women, because they know that if they were to die at a young age, the chances are pretty good their spouse could be remarried and probably to another woman who hasn't yet been married or sealed to another male. That would mean she would have to share her husband throughout eternity, and that is exactly how Dallin Oaks opened his message on October 5th, 2019, in the Saturday morning session of General Conference. He started off by reading a letter from, or at least mentioning a letter, from a woman who was concerned about what her eternal situation was going to be like. Now, the article that you referenced by Peggy Fletcher Stack, after Dallin Oaks gives this hypothetical, and can I read the first paragraph?
Please do.
Give your listeners a little bit of a background. Dallin Oaks opened up by saying, "My dear brothers and sisters, a letter I received some time ago introduces the subject of my talk. The writer was contemplating a temple marriage to a man whose eternal companion had died." In other words, the one she was planning to marry was already sealed for eternity to another woman. She would be a second wife. She asked this question: would she be able to have her own house in the next life, or would she have to live with her husband and his first wife? I just told her to trust the Lord. Now, in the article, it says that after he made these comments, there was a collective guffaw. I don't know if that's the proper word to describe the laughter. When I went back and I listened to him making this statement, you could tell most definitely he's kind of waiting for a response, and he has this little smirk on his face. But what I got from the laughter was more of a subdued chuckle, maybe even an uncomfortable chuckle, not a loud guffaw. And I think that tells us a lot. One, it tells us by Dallin Oaks even mentioning this subject that, yes, this is a very real doctrine in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to this very day. But at the same time, it also tells us that there's a lot of women in the church that aren't very comfortable with this. And he even goes on in his talk, right after telling that story, he goes on to tell another story about another family that was concerned about the same issue. And I'll tell you, Todd, this is something that bothers a lot of young women, and I can understand that. Polygamy is not the norm any longer. They didn't join the church with that in mind. They're not used to this. And, of course, polygamy is looked upon very negatively by most of our society, especially in the Christian community. And yet this is still a very real part of Mormon doctrine. The question is, and this article tries to raise this whole issue, well, what do most Mormons think about this? It's kind of a mixed bag. What Dallin Oaks says here when he says, "I just told her to trust the Lord," and there was laughter again after he said that, he doesn't answer the question. He doesn't answer the concern. And when I listened to it, and of course I read the transcript before I listened to it, I thought, man, he sounds awfully callous. I don't think he realizes, or if he does, he doesn't care. I don't think he realizes, or perhaps doesn't care, that there are a lot of female members in the church that find this to be very troubling. And yet he doesn't even try to address it, except to just blow off the question and say, well, trust the Lord. Man, it just told me that they've got a lot of problems when it comes to this doctrine.
So one of the other things that's kind of walked through in this Salt Lake Tribune article is the history of polygamy. It's obvious that Joseph Smith was a polygamist in many ways, but it really took off with Brigham Young, the second president. And I mean, he was notorious in my way of thinking for in his
polygamy. Yeah, he certainly was. He was more outspoken, that's for sure, because it became a public idea in the church in 1852 after the Mormons moved out to the Salt Lake Valley. Up until that time, it was still pretty much a secret doctrine that they didn't talk about a lot except in certain circles. But in August of 1852, that's when it was announced publicly by a Mormon apostle named Orson Pratt. And from that point on, the Mormons didn't hide it. Now, Joseph Smith, the church has even admitted this. The church has admitted that Joseph Smith, the founder, may have had as many as 40 wives. And that was just something they only admitted a few years ago. But yeah, everybody knows about Brigham Young's plural wives. And it's funny, Todd, because when you used to bring up the idea that Joseph Smith had wives, many Mormons would deny it. I remember getting into a conversation with a couple of sister missionaries in front of the Christus statue on Temple Square. And when I mentioned how I had been to the Joseph Smith Memorial Building and I was on their computers, I called up all the wives of Joseph Smith. They didn't even have all 40. I think they only had about 23 of them. She vehemently denied that, saying that Emma Smith, Joseph Smith's first wife, was his only wife. Now, since the church has admitted it, most Mormons don't argue that way, but it was funny how they had no problem with Brigham Young having many wives, but when you brought up the fact that Joseph Smith had many wives, many Mormons didn't want to believe that, which I've just found fascinating.
And it doesn't sound like there's uniformity of opinion, even among Mormon theologians, so to speak, about whether or not these plural marriages will continue on into eternity.
I don't know how they can deny it based on the whole idea of sealings for eternity. So you can be married and sealed to a woman for time, which means you don't have any plans of being with that woman after you both die. But to be married for eternity means that you will, in fact, be in a marriage relationship after you die, after the judgment, if you qualified for celestial exaltation, of course. But that is a hope that I think all the early pioneer Mormons, Brigham Young and John Taylor, I'm sure they all believed that they were going to be sealed for eternity to these women that they were sealed to in a special Mormon temple ceremony here on earth.
With a couple minutes left here, Bill, chicken or egg, is there evidence that these men were merely polygamists and they justified it by inventing a doctrine of celestial marriage, or is it that they actually, by force of their theology, said, well, this means we need to be polygamists? Where does it go there?
Well, if you go back to the story of Joseph Smith, the way he tells it is when God commanded him to take on a plural wife, he fought the notion. And there was this actual angel with a flaming sword telling him that he better do it, you know, or he's going to have dire consequences. So Joseph Smith gives this impression that he didn't really like the idea, but he was only being obedient to God, and that's why he did it. And, you know, not to be overly blunt, but you know what? That's almost exactly what we would expect from a cult leader. Act like you don't like it, but God was telling you to do it, so I had to acquiesce to be faithful to God. And of course, a lot of Mormons, looking at that example, would say, you know what, I'm not real comfortable with it either, but if Joseph Smith said that this was God's doctrine, then I'm going to go along with it too. Brigham Young kind of used the same type of argument, though he doesn't have quite as an elaborate story to tell on it, other than he just didn't like it at first. And like I tell people, I says, well, he seemed to have gotten over it quite readily, that's for sure.
Finally, with about a minute here, it seems as though at some point, there's going to have to be a choice made theologically. They could promulgate, I mean, they could today promulgate polygamy back into the church and wait for it to become legal. Is there a chance that even their internal PR might blow up in their faces if such a thing were to happen?
Well, I think the PR aspect would probably blow up in their faces, but when we consider that the whole revelation, I should say, for plural marriage is still found in the Doctrine and Covenants. It's section 132. And this is the revelation that Mormons always turn to justify this practice. Now, when they abandoned polygamy, or I should say when they were forced to abandon polygamy, they kind of changed some of the definitions of the wording there. So celestial marriage, which was always understood to be plural marriage, came to be known as merely a temple marriage for eternity. The language is still there. If you ask, well, would they have to pray about it? Would they have to vote on it? Probably they would go through all that just to make the people know that they did give this some real attention. But the revelation is still in their scriptures. It's still there. All it needs to be done is just to go back to the original intention of the words that are used in section 132. And you're right back to how it was practiced in the 19th century. If they're going to do that, certainly remains to be seen. I've talked to Mormons personally on both sides of this. Some don't have a problem with it, and some have a lot of problems with it. So, I don't know.
Bill McKeever is founder of Mormonism Research Ministry based in Draper, Utah. He is author of several books, including In Their Own Words, a collection of Mormon quotations, and Mormonism 101. You'll find a link to these books and to Mormonism Research Ministry at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Bill, thanks.
My pleasure.
We'll be talking about the origins of Thanksgiving Day with Cheryl Magnus on the other side of the break. It's actually a pretty complicated history, a lot of false starts, and the day as a national holiday, a lot younger than you might think. We'll get that story next.
Secularism, even when it's legally strong, even when it seems to control the commanding heights of academia, it's humanly weak because it cuts against basic human impulses and desires and aspirations.
New York Times columnist Ross Douthat speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
And it's also weak because people keep having intimations that the world is more than just a bunch of atoms clashing together. And so the religious impulse always makes a comeback. And in that sense, it isn't a question of whether you're going to have a secular or a religious public square. It's a question of what kind of religious public square you're going to have.
You can listen to Ross Douthat's presentation, Making the Case Why the Public Square Needs Christianity, on a recording from our 2019 Making the Case conference. We'll send it to you, along with a recording of Advent and Christmas hymns, for a year-end tax-deductible contribution of $300. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Ed Crusom offers Bible-based, Christ-focused Christmas ornaments in various sizes for church and home. Use our Jesse Tree collection to teach your children this Advent and see our new premium ornaments, a crucifixion tableau, angel and shepherds, the Holy Family, Epiphany, and much more. Visit adcrusom.com for unique and theologically sound greeting cards, jewelry, gifts, churchwares, banners, certificates, and housewares. That's adcrusom.com.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll study John the Baptist's swan song, Jesus and the Samaritan Woman, the true worship of God, the Samaritans believe in Jesus, and Jesus heals the official son. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, as we continue our walk through St. John's Gospel on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org, thewordendures.org.